All right, we're going to call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Finance to order. First on the agenda is the minutes. Representative Doty moves the minutes of February 10th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members and audience, today what we're doing is our last day of testimony that I can anticipate for the Ag Special Bill at the University of Minnesota. As you know, last year, 2 years ago, we wrote the Ag Special here between $50 and $55 million over to the university, and they utilize that in their Ag Extension and College Agriculture research and outreach activities. And we think it's a good exercise to put that bill together here, Representative Welty, eventually, and it'll be a few weeks where we have a bill figured out and put together, but Representative Welty will carry that over to Representative Rukavina's committee. So from this meeting on, or once we put the bill together, I don't want to see everyone go to Representative Welty's office from there on. And he did a good job 2 years ago. In fact, you can tell me, Representative Welty, I don't think they changed hardly a word. I think you took it over and did a good job explaining it, and Representative Rukavina just put it in his bill. So we're hoping for the same thing, and I think that's important because that means your testimony is important here. For those of you that are coming up today, again, we've got a list of eight or nine folks. We are going to be out of here by noon, so we really want your focus to be maybe briefly what your organizations are doing for research so we get an idea of what's going on around the state, and then how can you interface, or what do you see as needs at the university? Are there some interfaces that aren't being done with your group? Are there additional research you can't do or aren't doing that you think is necessary for the future of agriculture in this state, et cetera, et cetera? And again, if you can hold it to 5-10 minutes, because I'm sure there'll be some questions that would be desirable. And then members, and particularly staff, perk up and make sure you're writing down all this stuff so that we can sit down with Representative Magnus and myself and Hamilton and write that bill and bring it back so the committee can hopefully it accurately reflects what we're seeing here. And then obviously with the day we hear the bill, we have the opportunity to make changes and additions and subtractions that day from anyone on the committee, etc. So with that, are there any questions on the procedure? Seeing none, Brad Nelson is going to start off. He's with the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association. I should mention, as ethanol is coming up, it is my intent sometime in the near future to have an ethanol day here too, so we can understand their payments, you know, what plants get what, when do they come off the producer payment, the fiscal health of our plants, as we make a decision on that $15 million roughly that's still out there of ethanol payments. We know that's a hot topic again this year, and so we'll probably have a day where we're going to have plants and folks and the Department of Agriculture and others, and there's reports that are made every year to the Department of Agriculture on the fiscal health and other things of our ethanol plants, and so we want to look at that money situation and try and understand how we're going to deal with that in this budget. But that said, Mr. Nelson, welcome. Introduce yourself and proceed any way you see fit.
Thank you. My name is Brad Nelson. I am a Freeborn County farmer, Glenville Ethanol board member, and a member or president of the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association.
Are you represent Brown's constituent?
Yes, I do.
Very good. We always like to make note of that. So,
well, thank you.
All right.
And I would thank Chairman Junkie and the House Committee here for having us up here. And we are all about the market as far as what we are about here and about our business and access to it. And I want to start off by congratulating you as members of the legislature for allowing groups like ours to have a chance to break into the fuel business. We together, farmers, government, and ethanol firms, have achieved the goal that we have set out to do, to revitalize the rural parts of our state with new business, increased revenue for farmers, new employment in outstate Minnesota, and increased revenue for state and local governments. We have cleaned up our air and have not polluted our water. Even with the increased traffic on roadways, our air is cleaner than it was 20 years ago. We did not contaminate our water supply with MTBE, much like other portions of the country did while using it. In Minnesota, we have saved 1 year's gasoline usage and counting with our 10% blend of fuel. The programs put in place in the early 90s to get ethanol industry started have worked and have paid back the state like no other program has ever done. Now the ethanol industry is closing in on 10% of the nation's fuel supply. It has been an interesting year, to say the least. High-priced gas, high-priced corn, plants with financial problems, many sources attacking ethanol from everywhere with half-truths, lies, and propaganda. Studies quoted from Cornell Pimentel to the University of California, right here in Minnesota. Why is it happening? Because we have taken market share from the one and only other source of fuel in the world, and they are pushing back and pushing back hard. Break into the fuel market in many cases has taken government mandates, which in some circles is criticized sharply. I look at it today as we are mandated out of 90% of the fuel market because of EPA rules, vehicle warranties, and around the country, lack of availability, until recently of even 10% blends, let alone E85 or any other mid-level blends such as E20, E30, or E40. Yes, we are mandated out of these markets. I've kind of lost my place here. At any other blends, we are mandated out of the markets at any other blends, even though these blends work. And I am living proof of these blends working. I blend and have continued to blend higher levels in vehicles that I own. I finally bought my first flex fuel vehicle last summer, and it worked just fine to blend higher blends and non-flex fuel vehicles. And I am a common sense individual, and common sense tells me we are better off as a state exporting ethanol elsewhere using our own state's infrastructure, labor, land, and crops, than importing all of our fuel where, incidentally, 70% of our state's fuel comes from the Alberta tar sands, where, guess what, it is very high in water usage and environmentally unfriendly. That is one of the studies I have heard and read about. Why doesn't somebody publish that? Common sense tells me because someone hasn't paid them to. The governor of Texas last summer was out calling for the repeal of the renewable fuel standard because food prices were too high, until it was pointed out to him using data from a study at Texas A&M showing higher priced corn was not significantly driving up food costs. The facts today show corn has gone down 50%. Food company profits have shown record levels. Colin Peterson has called for an apology which has not come from the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Energy is more of a factor in food prices. Some stats for you. In corn flakes, a semi-load holds 4,200 boxes. The corn's value is $281.40. The average truckload of corn flakes or food travels 1,500 miles, and the cost to get that load to the store, $881.25. Why doesn't someone publish that? Common sense tells me because someone hasn't paid them to. Let's talk a little bit about water usage. We use water to make ethanol, but it's more like borrow water to make ethanol. Most water is released into the atmosphere in the form of steam. Non-contact water, in our case, goes to a drainage ditch cleaner than it was when we pumped it out of the ground. A few statistics for you today. We use or borrow 3 gallons of water for a gallon of ethanol production. Did you know that 1 gallon of refined gasoline uses 41.5 gallons of water? 1 pound of paper uses 100 gallons of water. 1 Sunday newspaper uses 150 gallons of water. Why doesn't somebody publish that? Common sense tells me because someone hasn't paid them to. Let's talk a little bit about greenhouse gases. A recent University of Nebraska study showed that modern ethanol plants reduce greenhouse gases by more than 50%. As technology has advanced, the amount of fossil fuel used to produce ethanol has continued to decline. And in our 10 years of history at Glenville Ethanol, we have reduced our use of fossil fuels. The natural carbon cycle, as we have learned when we were all in school, tells us plants clean the air. Corn fields that produce food and fuel do just that. Let's talk about oil imports a little bit. If the United States ethanol industry was a foreign oil producer, only Canada would provide the U.S. with more gasoline. Yes, we provide more fuel to the U.S. market than Saudi Arabia. The ethanol industry has become, once again, thanks to many of you, a major source of fuel for our country, providing jobs to people in our state, increasing the value of the crops we produce in the state, which increases revenue to the state itself. Without biofuels, gas prices would be 15% higher, according to Merrill Lynch. Without ethanol, we'd be using 7.2 billion gallons of gasoline in the U.S. to maintain current travel, according to the Department of Energy. Gasoline would be 20 to 35% higher without ethanol, according to the Department of Energy. The average American household is saving as much as $300 a year due to ethanol influencing gas prices. Why hasn't someone published that? Common sense tells me someone hasn't paid them to. Let's talk a little bit about jobs and economic activity. At a state level, a 50 million gallons per year plant adds $152 million annually to the size of the state economy, measured by gross domestic product. A 100 million gallon plant increases GDP by $300 million. The increased economic activity and new jobs results in higher levels of income. The ongoing annual operations of a 50 million gallon per year plant will increase household income by nearly $40 million, a 100 million gallon plant by $77 million. In 2007, the ethanol industry provided employment to 238,000 workers in all sectors of the U.S. economy and added $47.6 billion to the nation's gross domestic product and put an additional $12.3 billion into the pockets of American consumers. Why hasn't someone published that? Common sense tells me because someone hasn't paid them to. Let's talk a little bit about subsidies. Look at a Minnesota ethanol plant map. The Minnesota producer payments gave people like me a chance to finance a small facility by pooling resources with others and finding a lender and a builder. We have more than tripled in size, so we could ultimately have the size to survive long term. It has also helped me to try other ventures and grow my own business, providing jobs to others as well. According to ISU, the government gave domestic ethanol producers $1.3 billion in subsidies in 2007. It also put a 54-cent tariff on imported ethanol and a 51-cent credit to blenders that buy our product. In 2008, that credit has been lowered to 45 cents. In 2007, that tax incentive, that tax break, was $3.3 billion. But the ethanol industry returned $4.6 billion in tax revenue, and I can personally attest, and happily so, to reduce payments to farmers to the tune of $8 billion. So how are we really doing according to this data? Really good in all aspects. In fact, it is probably the best investment the government has made since the Louisiana purchase. On WCCO TV a week or so ago, they reported on the U of M study. They added at the end a statement that says, today E85 sells for $1.45 a gallon, and without subsidies would sell for $2.23 a gallon. Today a gallon of gasoline costs $1.85. Without subsidies, that same gallon would cost about $5.28 a gallon. That is a reality check. And we thank WCCO for exposing the truth. Which fuel would the American and Minnesota consumer choose economically with all subsidies removed? it is pretty easy to figure out. Say we hadn't started this industry, where would I be and the country be? After last year's crop alone, without this industry, there would be over 5 billion bushels of corn left over. What would that be worth? A dollar a bushel, maybe? The rural areas of the state would barely exist. People worry if there is enough corn. My own personal records show from 1997 to 2001 average yield, and from 2002 to 2008 the average crop off of my farm has increased by 36 bushels to the acre. History shows yields will continue to climb. I used to spend time recruiting for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association and the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, and I remember telling prospective members that complained about the price of corn, what will we do when we consistently produce an 8 billion bushel crop? Last year, with lower acres and a poor start to the growing season, we produced over 13 billion bushels. Where would farm subsidies be? Where would my family and I be without the ethanol industry? I hate to think about what might have been if all of us had not gone forward finding new uses for the crops we produce. Why hasn't somebody published that? Common sense tells me because someone hasn't paid them to. Here is one that is published. ExxonMobil, the leading U.S. oil company, in the third quarter of 2008 set a quarterly record profit for a U.S. company of $14.83 billion. The second quarter of 2008, a profit was made of $11.68 billion. Remember what I said at the beginning of my testimony. We are closing in on 10% of the nation's fuel market. They are starting to push back, and push back hard. 1% of one quarter's profit is $148 million. You can do a lot of fighting with that kind of money. BP funded, through a grant, a $500 million study at the University of California. What did we get out of that? Indirect land use. Another piece of information off the ExxonMobil report is this. They made an interest payment of $170 million related to punitive damage from the Valdez oil spill off the coast of Alaska in 1989. When was the last time you heard of an environmental harm caused by an ethanol spill? I have been involved in this industry for 15 years. I personally know three of the major players in this industry. They all had a part in building the plants in Glenville. Two of them are from Minnesota. Ron Fagan of Granite Falls, Minnesota, Dave Vandegrind of Colwich, Kansas, and the Broins from Wanamingo, Minnesota. Jeff Broin is the CEO of Pullet, based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They have worked together along with organizations such as MEPA to fight this continual battle. They sponsor an Indy racing team, and currently for the last two seasons, the IRL has been powered totally by ethanol. This displays that the highest performing vehicles in racing do just fine on ethanol. Dave Vandegrind has helped two stations in Kansas become blender pump locations while using employee vehicles and company vehicles as test models for higher blends. Ron Fagan has a great love of flying and sponsors planes at air shows that run on ethanol. Together, all of us have formed a group called Growth Energy that are now employing four-star general and former presidential candidate Wesley Clark. Growth Energy is also working with former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich to help us fight our battles out in Washington and New York.
Mr. Nelson, if you can move towards the end of our
done.
All right.
We have worked hard to find advertising agencies out east that are not employed by the oil industry. Well over 140 agencies couldn't be used. Money from oil companies and countries with oil is spread pretty thick everywhere. When was the last time any of our National Guard units were deployed to protect an ethanol plant or a cornfield? How many Mideast countries pay taxes in Minnesota? What countries were the 9/11 hijackers from? When we think of all these items, what does common sense tell you? Ethanol is here, ethanol is today, ethanol brings us jobs, ethanol improves our state's economy, and its residents' lives. Ethanol gives us greater national security. Someone ought to publish that. Today we are at a crossroads. Will the propaganda that we hear today prevent us from moving forward, such as Project Liberty, or the ethanol plants in the countryside become vacant reminders of what could and should have been? Thank you for the role that you have played and continue to play to make all our lives better and safer by using and promoting these renewable fuels. And I would thank you for your time. And once again, I would say we are all about access to the market.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Obviously, listening to that, we can tell how frustrating it has been for biofuel producers like ethanol plants and with what's out there in the media. By the way, I was handed, wherever it went here, I was handed, for those who didn't read it, I didn't read it till today, but Star Tribune has an editorial on the biodiesel problem down at the Bloomington School today, basically pointing out that it was a total mistake and had nothing to do with biodiesel. Amazing that we're getting a positive response back in a major paper in the state. So it does show if we keep working at it, our messages will get out. I've written down 6 different items, IDP out of your testimony, and we appreciate that. Does anyone have any questions for the ethanol folks? Like I say, we'll have you and others back for a longer discussion on ethanol in the next over the next month or so sometime. All right, very good. Oh, Representative Brown.
Just got to give a quick thank you for coming up and testifying, and Mr. Nelson has been very good about educating me about ethanol, gave me a tour of the plant, and has been a very strong advocate, as you can see right here, and thank you for coming up and speaking with us.
Thank you for your comments and for your visit to our facility.
All right, very good. Next is the corn growers. Mr. Tumbleson. I figured the ethanol was part of the corn growers' testimony, too, so I'm going to hold you to 5 or 10 minutes here, or I'm not going to get through everyone. And by the way, for people that have more testimony than that, or you have a statement, please submit it to our folks either electronically later or leave a copy here, and we'll make sure it's sent out to members one way or another. So we'll make sure everything you brought will get distributed. Welcome. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, thank you for giving me this opportunity, Chairman and Representatives. I'm Gerald Tumbleson, and I farm in Martin County, Minnesota. We raise corn, soybeans, and a lot of pigs, which we fertilize our land with and try to maintain a kind of a wheel so we don't have to export everything out of the United States, and we can just export protein out. Now, for this meeting, you're not going to believe it, but I'm not going to talk that much about ethanol.
Right.
We're going to talk about the research that the corn growers would like you to fund through the university and where it's going. And I hope you have a copy of this in front of you someplace. But I will just hit, for sake of time, some of the high points of this. But the number one thing I want you to understand is the 20th century with a hydrocarbon economy. The United States became number one in the world from hydrocarbons. We all know that. That's where it led us. But we have to all now understand that the 21st century is the beginning of a carbohydrate economy. That is the big thing that's going to happen. And it happens because the world is short of two things: energy and protein. Basically, that's all the world is short of, is energy and protein. Now, that's not all, because that's the major things in the world. That I want you to understand as I go through this speech. The other part of it is I want you to understand that Ag Business 101 is in 180 degrees from Business 101. In Business 101, if you have 10 cars to sell, you have 11 buyers, you have a fantastic market. In Ag Business 101, just the opposite. The more you produce, the higher the price. That's very difficult for a lot of people to understand, but that's a fact you have to get in your head to start with to understand where we're going in the corn growers with research. Years ago, had a pile of corn so large we couldn't use it. We did research on it. We have a tremendous corn price. We got sued by Canada because of our farm bill, which has subsidies. I went up there, my wife and I spoke across Canada. Fortunately, I've been with the National Corn Growers and spoke around the world on this issue. And thank you, people from Minnesota, that I can use Minnesota's and Minnesota model and ethanol. That is one speech that's very happy for me to give. But what happens in here, the more you produce, the more research you can get done, the more you can supply, and the price goes up. Now, we have to be very careful on that, because if you're going to do that correctly, you do not export a raw commodity. Any country, I've spoken in Australia and around the world and in Europe and in Canada, and as you'll see on the sheet, there are only four places in the world that can export the sun. Now, I'm talking about exporting it through photosynthesis, and that's a carbohydrate. That will be the future OPEC, those four places. Now, I use that word OPEC in the sense of what it is today. That is the future. And if we do it correctly, if we do our research correctly here and do our present our opportunities correctly, we will be the OPEC. Some of the things that we need on OPEC, as you can read through, is the taxation thing. We talk taxation, everybody says, you can't change taxes. Well, do you want a subsidy or do you want to build Minnesota? We found out through the Minnesota model, we can build Minnesota with an incentive program. If you could take Lincoln County, for instance, and you build a pig plant or an ethanol plant or something, and everybody who invests into that out there, the first $20,000 you make, you pay no income tax on. If you're living in a city, you go, oh man, what an advantage. No. When that person invests $20,000, if it's ADM, $20,000 isn't going to make any difference. But the person who invests $20,000 saves $3,000 on taxes, guess where they're going to spend it? It's not enough money to take it out of the United States. Spend it in Lincoln County. Look what it does to rural development. That little incentive, look at the jobs it creates. Minnesota will benefit way more from the jobs it creates than losing the $20,000. But now that is an opportunity for people. You haven't cost the government anything because the plant wouldn't be there without it. Now it's there. And the same with a graduated tax. If you make $50 million in your corporation or whatever it is, and you pay a 20% tax, you pay, what, $10 million or something? But if you made $50 million and you paid 80% tax, you would not take that money to Mexico and build a plant. You wouldn't pay the tax on it. I guarantee you wouldn't do that. So if you're making tin cans and you made $50 million, you build another plant to make tin cans. Guess where you're going to build it? Right here, where you can use the tax advantage and not pay the tax. These are some of the things that we can do, and that's what the Minnesota Corn Growers is pushing for, is that kind of an approach of where we're going with this. Now, when we do the research, to be excessive supply, to get a higher price, you have to have some place to produce it from. We have the soil out there. And we are doing research. We are spending millions. In the last 3-4 years, we have spent multi-millions at the university through the corn growers. We want it spent on soil and water, on production end and then on usage end. Look what we spent for ethanol. Look at what we spent for pigs, for cattle. That's what we want. We want that raw material used right there, and then we export the pork chop, the protein. Look at the amount of fuel it does not take to export a bulk supply of protein and do that. Now, you say, okay, your price goes up. Can a foreign country do that? Yes. When we were in Africa, you could not raise corn for a dollar a bushel. You couldn't even plant it. Nobody would loan you money to do it. $4 a bushel, the banks will loan them the money to plant it. They will produce a product that won't be good enough for their food use, but look at what we can do. We can supply the protein to that product they're producing. Now their economy starts to go. The wheels start to roll down there. It takes a little while because now they can buy more hoes because they planted the corn, made some money, and the person selling the hoes. That's how the wheel rolls. Price, higher prices makes the economy grow, and even in the poorer countries where most of the agriculture, guess what $4 corn did? It allowed them to plant it. Now, to get that production, we have to have research for our production, and we have to do it in a friendly, environmentally way. That's what we're doing in our research today, and we have to prove. We do not want models to be our example. We want facts. Now, that's difficult because you do need models to start this. But the models have given us what has come out in the Tribune a couple of days ago. Those are models. We don't need models. We need facts. So when we get the facts, we have to start with production. We were at one time saying that agriculture was polluting our, didn't TMDLs, that's the turbidity of our rivers at 80%. We're down to less than 30, maybe less than 20% of ag land. It will get down to less than 5%. It will get there because we're doing the research through the University of Minnesota. We have great researchers that we've come at the university in the economy department. We have a big problem with. You know that. But anyway, the rest of them, we need the university for this. We have to have it here in Minnesota. We're on the top of the Mississippi, or the Minnesota River in Mississippi, and we're going to get this job done. We need the natural background of what happens to us, so we have to go out and do the research. We also need to know what we're doing with our tillage. Years ago, we were basically using iron to till, and when it rained, we washed soil away. Our tiling now has stopped erosion on my farm. Sheet erosion is almost eliminated from tiling. Now we have people say we can't tile because we have nutrients on our tile. We are using less nitrogen per bushel than we've ever used. We are doing the research out there. We don't want emotion coming into the equation in the newspaper saying, I already said, maybe they deserve to be filed bankruptcy for what they've been writing. The last couple of days, I'm kind of leaning maybe they don't need bankruptcy right now. But anyway, that's what we're doing at the university, and that's what we want to do. There's a book out right here on the energy factory. We have ethanol being debated today on the sale of Verisun to a petroleum company. If they're purchased, you know where that profit goes? It will not be in Minnesota. And I am very disappointed. I want all the profits from those to stay here, revolve, the wheel turns, and move it 7-8 times. That's how an economy grows. We're doing the research in Minnesota to get that done. And I'm very disappointed. This is an example of what we're doing. We can't give it to you because we're working on it in the Minnesota Corn Growers, and it takes every one of those. What we're really the top of the issue is the security of the United States and Minnesota. That's our number one issue. The Roman Empire did not fail from without. It failed from within. The United States will go down from within, not from without. Once we get this wheel put together on the security, and the middle one is excess production, and we need the taxes, we need the capital, we need the trade, and we need the environment. That's why we're doing research today, big time, in the environment and how we produce our crops. Now, I could go on for an hour.
But you can't.
But you're going to stop. So I am going to stop. If you have any questions on this, this is where the Minnesota is going, and Minnesota Corn Growers Research and Promotion Council. We got to advance in our checkoff. Hopefully we can do more with the university, and with your help, we'll partner.
All right. Thank you very much. We do appreciate your passion on these issues, and look forward to more testimony from you. Any questions for the corn growers? We've got your sheet, took some notes, and you'll be part of what we do. So next we have Farmers Union coming up. By the way, there is coffee up there if anyone wants a cup. Help yourself. There's also a can. I see Jarek's in the room for the first time. Ronnie Jarek usually prepays because he knows his phone will go off. If your phone goes off, you owe $1 to our coffee jar. And if you answer it, it's $5.
You owe me $10 from last year.
Yeah. Welcome, Representative Peterson, one of three generations of Petersons in western Minnesota. Now we have Representative Falk. Falk, is your mom's maiden name Peterson? Or?
But I felt like I was adopted into the family.
All right, very good. Welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Junkie, and committee members. My name is Doug Peterson. I'm the president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and the two people before me have certainly laid out some very good arguments, and I only want to say a few words today. First is that agriculture has changed, and you all know that, changed significantly. And the aspect of research that comes to agriculture has to be done, I believe, in a public domain at the University of Minnesota. And I want to really congratulate the authors of this bill. Having read this, and in the number of years that I was in the legislature, that was 6 terms or 12, I've read a lot of bills. This bill is very well put together. This bill says a lot of things, and I think this bill sets the direction for lots of initiatives through the state of Minnesota. And having said that, the Minnesota Farmers Union is a general farm organization. We deal with lots of different aspects, everything from ethanol to health care for our members and also for the state of Minnesota and for its rural constituencies and also our city cousins. But I appreciate being here today, and I want to say that this is a good process, Mr. Chairman. some frustration in the later or earlier years on ag specials when I sat around this table that it was all in the higher ed, and ag people never got a chance to actually have input on what happened at the University of Minnesota in agricultural research. That has now changed, Mr. Chairman. I want to congratulate you and Mr. Rukavina for those insights and also making sure that that did happen. I think it's a much better place. We have talked with the dean of the DAG school. We've had good communication with him. He's done a tremendous job. He came to our convention annual meeting and spoke, communicated with our members, and kind of laid out what the university is about. Ag education for us is a high priority. We think that more that you can educate, being a former teacher myself, the more that you can educate the general public and also farmers through either extension or things that go in the paper, the better off we are in agriculture. We've got some good people. I want to recognize Glenn Arstrom from Wilmer, who's a former ag educator who's done a really, really good job of doing some of these things. Because I'm sometimes surprised how many times I ask farmers if they've talked with extension about the problems, and it's really not there yet. So we've got to do a little bit more work on that. As you know, Mr. Chairman, the fertilizer research is so terribly important. We have the issue of the checkoff council, but the application rates, those things have to be considered, because if we're going to do the right thing for the land and also production, we certainly have to have the research that does look at the resources that are available, especially when some of our prices haven't gone down. I think it's kind of interesting, kind of sidebar here, that food prices have not come down. Food prices have not come down. Drop in commodity prices almost half. And we're going into a spring, and ladies and gentlemen and committee members, I always say it this way. Farmers have to hit a home run all the time. They have to hit a home run in production. They have to hit a home run in marketing, and then also with the weather. And what we have against us typically is Mother Nature, and she always bats last and always clean up. So you should remember that when you talk to a farmer. There are things out there. So that's why we have the university. Livestock, especially the dairy products and the co-products of dairy, have to be researched. I think one of the fastest growing pieces of this bill that you have in front of you is the ongoing organic research, the pest management, the alternative medicines. Those things are still growing quite rapidly. We also, our members, have continued working for the development of renewable fuels and energy sources from biomass researchers. That kind of goes without saying, but I believe that if you look at the biofuels industry in the country, this in 2008, we would be number, if we were a foreign country, we would be number three in imports of fuel. In 2009, we will be number one if we were a foreign country. That is where we have gone from having biofuels research. And I want to say this, and I don't want to offend anybody. There is not a perfect agricultural renewable fuel. And we have to get onto that bridge and move to the next generation of fuels. And without the research from the University of Minnesota, whether it be good or be bad, that is on our side to make sure that all things are equal. But we need to move this down the road as a state and as a country, and Minnesota's done quite well in biofuels. We've got a $7 billion investment in rural Minnesota just in ethanol alone, and the infrastructure is terribly important. The only thing I want to say is, yes, some of our members, Mr. Chairman, have lost faith in the University of Minnesota, and it is a land-grant college. I don't want to beat up on anybody. They do need to do the necessary research to improve the lives of our members and people in rural Minnesota. And things like closing of extensions offices and the issues of patenting on the apples, I don't know if anybody remembers that issue of a couple years ago. And then there is some concern over the biofuel research. I think it's incumbent upon us as the industry people, or as agricultural producers, or I like to say farmers, to combat that. And at the same time, there has to be an integrity within the university to have independent research. And it is the University of Minnesota, land-grant college. And the processes that I have been involved in, Mr. Chairman and committee, with the university, specifically when you go through that rapid response assessment has been very well done. It's been very well managed. And I think, you know, if you're going to take $50 or $55 million and put it into an institution, this is money well spent. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Very good. And good points. As was pointed out yesterday, the milk producers, your comment about food, milk prices are 50% of what they were a year ago. Commodity prices are 50% of what they were a year ago. Fuel prices are 50% less than what they were a year ago. Food prices haven't dropped in half.
Yeah.
So we have some good evidence before us. Any questions for Farmers Union? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson. Bill Bond, Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, followed by Bruce Claven. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Bond. I represent the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. We're a small trade association representing primarily the dealers, the retailers that serve Minnesota farmers, and to a lesser extent, the distributors and manufacturers. Today I'm going to limit my comments to 3 points, and two of them are, I think, to commend the university. First of all, we had a short course, we called it, which provided good education for our members. The university had a short course that was more targeted and I think probably a better educational experience. And about 3 years ago, we decided to combine those two programs. The university is primarily responsible for the educational component, and the result of that is, I think, a better experience and a better educational value for the folks that really do provide the guidance to farmers as they're thinking about their crop inputs.
And I was there, Mr. Bond, as well as years ago when I worked in the industry. I used to go and I would remind you to send everyone an invitation for the one coming up next December, I suppose, and see if we can get as many members as we can down there, because it is worthwhile. There's a large display at the Minneapolis Convention Center. It's all farm businesses, ag-related things, plus you have the U of M short courses and your folks with your studies, and it's a good event, and a lot of members should try and attend that.
I will make a point of that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. In addition, I'd like to suggest that we also represent the Certified Crop Advisors. It's another small part of our organization, but in fact, there are over 750 Certified Crop Advisors throughout the state of Minnesota, and Bev Durgan from the university serves on our board of directors as well as a couple of her staff, and they, in that regard, they help us design the questions that go on the certification exam that relate to Minnesota agricultural inputs. So we have a very very specific exam that the Certified Crop Advisors are required to pass that has that input, and again, thanks to the university. So those we find our experience working with the university very positive. And then finally, talking a little bit about AFRAC, the Ag Fertilizer Research and Education Council, that, Mr. Chairman, as you're aware, we had a strong interest in that from its inception and conception. I think to reveal, we really don't. We're a small organization. We don't have funds or a checkoff program to fund research, but we have a strong interest in it because it's primarily these days the salespeople and the crop advisors and crop consultants who advise farmers as to their inputs. And because of the closing of extension offices throughout the state, that is the source of information for most inputs. And so we need to have a constant flow of production ag research flowing to our members. And as a result, we actually, I think at one point, envisioned that AFRAC could be a checkoff program for the fertilizer part of the crop input industry, but our customers changed their minds. The farmers wanted to take ownership of the council. As you know, we used the task force or the interim to really study that, and out of that came, I think, a really good model of the ag input industry, in this case fertilizer, coming together and having a buy-in as to the decisions and the accountability of research going forward. As we think about the research that's going on at the university, basic research is extremely important. We don't want to interfere with academic freedom at all. On the other hand, to the extent that modern production ag research goes on, a little more accountability in terms of a review similar to the AFRAC model may serve us well. We ultimately have to get that research into the hands of the folks that are going to use it. And to the extent that we can redesign voluntarily, that you can bring in a more model of accountability, the better off we're going to be going forward. And it's more of a reminder to, and a compliment to them. They are moving that way. We think the journey isn't complete yet, and that could continue down that road. With that, I'll end my comments, and thank you for the opportunity.
Very good. Any questions for our crop retailer? All right. Thank you very much. Bruce Claven. Welcome. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Claven. Today I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Wheat Growers and the Minnesota Barley Growers Association. And, Mr. Chairman, my comments will be in response to your request last week that we talk about the research needs from the various commodity groups. The state legislative initiative on SCAB was started back in 95. And I talked to former Representative Tunheim, who was in the audience this morning, too, and he probably represented the hardest hit area at the time. Back in 93, they had to burn the fields up in the valley due to the SCAB outbreak. Well, that led to the SCAB initiative in 1995. The legislature appropriated $1.625 million that year to start the initiative. We partnered with other states and the federal government and even Canada to get that disease under control. That resulted in better understanding the disease, improved varieties. There are now SCAB-resistant varieties. It resulted in a better understanding of how to use the fungicide and crop rotations even, because it was discovered that the spores would end up staying in the residue, particularly corn stalks, and people hadn't realized that up until that time. There's also a state wheat breeder position funded out of the Ag Special, and this is really important to the growers. And the reason for that is wheat relies heavily, as Mr. Peterson mentioned, on the public university, the public domain, for the varieties. You see in soybeans Roundup Ready out of Monsanto, and you see BC corn. Those are done by privates. We don't have the privates in the wheat industry or in the barley industry. And so they rely heavily on the new the developments from the university. The extension dollars also do outreach in the valley. And this is something I think one of the other testifiers mentioned. We don't always have that interface, but in the valley they do. Up in Crookston and Morris in particular, the extension agents have lots of meetings with the growers about small grain management and growing practices, nitrogen uptake, and so forth. And so the outreach and extension hasn't been touched on as much, but in particular in Morris and Crookston, that's an issue. They're currently working on advanced breeding molecular markers. It's not what you'd maybe call GMO, but it's molecular markers in the plant stems themselves. And they're breeding those right now. There's insect management, and finally water management strategies. It's something that they've discovered through the university. And Mr. Bond was talking about fertilizer. But water management, wheat and barley can get what's called wet feet very quickly. And especially in the valley when it rains a lot and sits in the flat area, wet feet can cause yield problems quickly in small grains. And so water management is another thing that happens with university research. Mr. Chairman, I have a couple other comments from two other groups, and that would be the Minnesota Turkey Growers. It's another group I represent, and they also wanted to go on the record for two things today. First, to let you know that avian influenza and diseases within the flocks is something that they have worked with the university on over the years. They use their checkoff dollars, like the other groups, to leverage the state share of that, and we have a lot of involvement through the Rosemount facility and some positions there with graduate students and so forth in the turkey industry. Second thing they wanted to mention was about the relocation of that. Some of you may remember a couple of years ago in the paper, there's going to be a utopia down south of town here. When you make the utopia, you have to move the turkey research barn that's there. So there's been some discussions. They've been very supportive about continuing the facility. It may go out to Wilmer. I think that's where the location is being talked about, but the point is it's going to be moved from where it is in Rosemount. And we may be back for bonding dollars or some support down the road for that. Not today, but someday. Maybe we can have construction jobs, Mr. Chairman, stimulate the economy. But that's important to the growers, that research barn, for the turkey industry. And finally, Mr. Chairman, give you some comments on the Turf Seed Council. I wanted to get some record, put that record on Turf Seed Council. Some of you, Mr. Chairman, were up in the valley. This was our northernmost stop on the tour. Representatives Doty and Faust and Cheryl Tremba were on that trip. This was the station we were up by Rosa, the very northernmost point, where we walked in the fields and saw the legumes and the mixed grass. The two projects those folks are working on is seed varieties, but also biomass in terms of improved yield. There's a lot of cellulosic discussion in the building down here in recent years. They're working on the biomass angle from the improved yield for that. They have graduate student positions, and they've got 10 plots. Some of you have those in your districts in places like Morris and Lamberton, Staples, Crookston, Sabika, Grand Rapids. They have plots, and the reason they have them around the state is to see how the temperatures vary on the research. It's different up where Representative Eakin would be versus Representative Brown. So they're doing varieties around the state, and that's on the biomass project. But so, Mr. Chairman, as you can see, a lot of needs with the folks I work with at the university on the ag specials. So those are my prepared remarks. I'll stand for questions.
Very good. Any questions for these three groups? Yes, Representative Brown.
Just a quick question. You mentioned wheat and barley. Do you have any connection with the oat growers for oat research?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, I do not. I think there's an oat association, but I don't have any connection with it.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Bob LaFave, Minnesota Milk. And welcome, Representative Tunheim. Raise your hand. There we go. Some folks might not know you. I served with Jim for a number of years. He was, at the time, the chair of the Commerce Committee back when. He used to have a subcommittee. It was called the Controversial Bill Subcommittee. And so he used to re-refer his bills down there. And for some reason, the chair of that subcommittee never called a meeting. That was amazing. So anyway, Mr. LaFave.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob LaFave. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. I'm going to try to keep it extremely short because I know there's no way I'm going to be able to do as good as Sadie Frerich did yesterday, so I'm not even going to try to come close. First of all, I just want to say how thank you for the opportunity to be here. Obviously, research and education outreach is extremely important to the dairy industry in Minnesota. And we also do thank the work of Dean Al Levine and Bev Durgan and Trevor Ames. We recognize it's a difficult position that they're in. I think everyone would agree. I hope that they certainly do want to serve agriculture as best as possible, given the difficult circumstances they're in. And one of those difficult circumstances that they're in is really serving the dairy industry. One of the items that we would ask for within the Ag Special is support for the University of Minnesota for the planning, the site selection, engineering, and design work for a new dairy research, teaching, and consumer education facility. The existing facilities at the University of Minnesota are old. There is real no clear future plan at the University of Minnesota to serve the vast majority of dairy producers, the 95% of Minnesota's dairy producers. There have been, as Doug Peterson alluded to earlier, great direction on organic research. We have, I believe, which will be should be recognized as the top organic dairy facility in the country in Morris, and the work that's going to be coming out of there. I think as a result of that, the information should be providing, or will be providing, I believe, our grazers and organic dairy producers with the best information available. And that, I certainly think, is something that the university in Minnesota in general should be proud of. But we also need to see a way in which we can serve the other 95% of dairy producers in Minnesota, which goes back to the design, site selection, and planning and engineering for a new facility. A new facility, we believe, will also help the University of Minnesota be more cost-effective. It'll allow them to be more focused rather than having numerous facilities, some of which actually are not doing any research at all, one in particular related to dairy. So I think there's an opportunity in times when obviously the state is in budget challenges, the University of Minnesota will be challenged. We need to take this opportunity to look for ways in which we can reinvent the University of Minnesota and do a much better job in serving the dairy industry, in particular for the for us, and as well for the public. We believe a new facility will allow the University of Minnesota to effectively serve the dairy industry for many years to come. With the existing facilities they have, what they can do is extremely limited, unfortunately. So I don't have a lot of existing research ideas that the University of Minnesota is doing because it is so limited. They have great people there, but what they can turn out is fairly limited. The second item that we would like to ask for you to give some consideration to is a master dairy producer program, if you will, a master's dairy producer program, really to develop and implement a blended learning professional dairy producer continuing education curriculum or program. We have right now in Minnesota, and you saw an example of that yesterday, a growing segment of dairy producers with post-secondary education. And this group, as it continues to grow, it also has an unquenchable thirst for quality research-based knowledge that will help them to improve the care for their animals. It will help them improve the natural resource stewardship. It will help to sharpen their business skills and ultimately to improve their way of life. We see a curriculum, a master's curriculum, focused on that segment of a growing dairy producer population is something that the University of Minnesota could do and should do to serve them. And so we'd encourage some resources to help the University of Minnesota develop a system and a curriculum or program for that. Those are two items that we would just like to stress today within ag appropriations, and I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions from members? I have one comment. The testimony yesterday was fantastic, and please, was it Mr. Frederick?
Frederick, yes.
Please, if you would send that message back to her as well. We'd love to have her back and testify at any point in time. Now that the chairman stepped out, I'll say that. She's welcome anytime. All right, any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is Mr. Comerford from the Minnesota Soybean Growers. And after that, we have Mr. Schoenfeld from the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators. Is that right? Oh, before you get started, we have an interesting tidbit here that Mr. Comerford was on Representative Doty's wrestling team. 119 pounds, is that accurate?
That was a few years ago.
Mr. Comerford, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and please proceed.
My name is Steve Comerford. I work with the Minnesota Soybean Growers and Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council as a research coordinator for them. I've put together a list of a bunch of different production-related research type of projects that the soybean growers have through needs assessment meetings that we've held with producers. They've recognized these as high priority areas. I guess I'd like to introduce Jerry Schoenfeld, the lobbyist for the soybean growers, and he was going to handle much of this discussion here. I was going to be more the technical backup person. So.
Okay, very good. Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, welcome. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. The hat I'm wearing at this moment is with the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, and evidently Mr. Comerford was easier on the math than wrestled better on the math than he did with what he wants to do with the legislature, so he passed the ball off to me.
Very nice.
First of all, Mr. Chairman, one of the things I wanted to indicate, because some people may not be aware, most commodity groups deal with the University of Minnesota through research efforts. This Minnesota Soybean Growers, though, I believe is the number one commodity group in terms of dollar amounts that go to the university. And some people may not recognize that, for instance, with the Minnesota Soybean Growers, that there is a checkoff that takes place on every bushel, basically, of soybeans that is provided for research and development activities. Those research range anywhere from soybean varieties and disease management on one hand to things like the biodiesel legislation that we passed here a couple years ago and last year, that research efforts that went into the development of biodiesel as an example. So they're in a wide range of things. This year, the Minnesota Soybean Research Council will invest about $1.5 million at the University of Minnesota. And I stand to be corrected by Mr. Comerford for anything I might get incorrect here, but I believe it's about $1.5 million this year. If you look at the total needs of Minnesota soybeans in terms of per acre, I recognize that Minnesota is right near the top in terms of soybean production across the United States, we have it is depending upon the year ends up is to be either one of the top two crops in the state, our placement in terms of the value to Minnesota's economy. I believe we're third in the nation in terms of soybean production in terms of all states. If you look at the research needs that are with the University of Minnesota and you think about it on a per bushel basis or a per acre basis, the total research needs that Minnesota soybean growers are invested in amount to the losses that are there within soybeans are 15 to 20 bushels per acre if you take all of the different research needs combined. We have four primary priorities within it. One of those, and I think it gives a good indication of how this all works between the private dollars of the soybean growers and the investment dollars of the legislature and those of the University of Minnesota. Some years ago when Representative Neff was chairman of this committee, the Minnesota soybean growers came before us and they requested money for several diseases, cyst nematode research, white mold, and a couple of others. This legislature at that time provided $1 million that basically ended up as startup funds for that. In addition to that, the legislature a couple years later, through its bonding proposals, also added several research facilities that provided top in the nation in terms of dealing with diseases that could affect Minnesota soybeans. And so the legislature has had a strong partnership in all of this in your past. But to give you an idea, once that $1 million that the legislature came forth with, that wasn't in a base funding proposal. So it was a special amount of funds at that time that started much of the cyst nematode research. The university has added funds of their own into it, along with funds from the Minnesota Soybean Growers. And this year, the request from the Minnesota Soybean Growers for research efforts is about $250,000. Not all of which will be able to be funded by the soybean growers. But that's the request of the soybean growers for cyst nematode research. And so I kind of give you that as an example of something that has had legislative money put into it, money from the university, particularly the Ag Special, and in addition to that, a lot of funds from soybean growers themselves. I guess, Mr. Comfort, if you could tell me, from 1976, I think, on, what was the total dollar amount that the soybean growers were putting into it?
If you include what's budgeted to be funded this year, there would be close to $21 million.
So there are significant dollars coming from the farmers themselves joining with the research of the university. And yet, like probably all people who come before this committee, we always feel that there needs to be more dollars in terms of research effort. But anyway, I did want to include today to you the four research efforts, or the four major areas of research that soybean growers are interested in. The first is disease and soybean cyst nematode management research. It includes such things as research how to manage the yield and quality limiting effects of soybean cyst nematodes. On a per acre basis, this amounts to about 5 to 10 bushels per acre, and about $200 million of cost to Minnesota farmers. On an annual basis. Soybean farmers need research to develop new soybean cyst nematode management strategies. Populations are breaking the resistance of existing varieties, and so new varieties are needed. And soybean cyst nematode is rapidly moving into northwest Minnesota. And because of the different soil types and the different kinds of weather conditions that exist there, some additional research needs to be to deal with that that may be a little different than other parts of the state. Secondly, so the first research priority is disease and soybean cyst nematode management research. The second priority is cultural practices research and extension education efforts. For instance, at the experiment station in Waseca, there's a significant amount of research that's being done with cyst nematodes. But to get that from the research level to the individual farmers in the field as such requires a good extension service and a good transference and a lot of communication. And so we feel that there needs to be increased efforts in those areas for the extension education efforts. The third area that I would talk about is the soybean breeding program. And again, using soybean cyst nematode is just one example, and there are several diseases that we could talk about. The breeding program existing varieties become resistant over time to herbicides. They become resistant to disease problems and so forth. And so we need new research and new varieties that will help overcome that problem. And the last is insect management research. Oftentimes the role of insects combines with funguses and so forth that cause these soybean problems. And so Minnesota soybean farmers need research into how best manage soybean aphids, as an example. Soybean aphids are a pest that was introduced into Minnesota about 10 years ago and continue to be a very severe pest for soybean farmers. There's a need for expanded research into new biological control strategies, particularly in light of a lot of concerns about fungicides, insecticides, and that kind of thing. Soybean farmers need more research to identify the best approaches for managing soybean aphids. 2008 was the worst year in Minnesota for soybean aphids since they were first introduced. One of the other things that I would mention to this is that as a response to some of these problems, not only to soybeans, but also to wheat and other types of crops. Several years ago, I think it was about a dozen years ago, the legislature did institute some special funds that were provided for rapid response funds. And I can tell you also that there have been at least two occasions in which research that took place with the soybean cyst nematodes was funded through the Rapid Response Fund as well, because it was a new kind of emerging disease. So it is a combination of a lot of things. It is a combination of special funds that the legislature gives, special funds through the Ag Special, funds, the $20-some million that have been invested by soybean growers themselves to the university over time, and in addition to that, other forms of federal grants and a lot of other things. So it's kind of a complex issue, but bottom line is these are the four research needs that soybean growers go to need.
Any questions from members? I have one. We took testimony from the DNR and the Department of Ag. Your thoughts on are we set up, are we structured, or have the proper measures in place to address invasive species here in Minnesota?
I know there's efforts in that area to address that. I think that can be challenging. The question is, if you knew what the invasive species is, then you can work on it. But the biggest challenge is knowing what the next invasive species is and being able to be proactive to avoid that. A good example is if we had an idea of the soybean aphid would be moving in. It was accidentally introduced from Asia in around 2000, and the impact of that on soybean production now is huge. It's estimated to impact 5 to 10 bushels annually if not optimally managed. So I think the Department of Ag has done a commendable job in the challenges that they have, but being able to look ahead, I think, is the biggest one, and maybe an effort to look at the stakeholders in terms of what might be coming into play in the future. Maybe that could be an area that could be expanded on.
All right, thank you.
Yes,
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Question going back to the breeding program with soybeans. With the increased cost of Roundup and the resistance to weeds by Roundup, is the breeding program at all looking back at more conventional lines, or is everything pretty much all on the Roundup-ready variety?
Mr. Comfort.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The University of Minnesota's breeding program has been fairly aggressively funded by the soybean checkoff over the years. It's one of the elite programs in the country, produces probably the greatest number of soybean breeders from any entity. There's not many soybean breeding programs left in the country. Its foundation is conventional soybean breeding, and then only recently has Roundup been introduced into the breeding program, Roundup Resistance. So it is really the premier conventional public soybean breeding program in the country right now, and it's responsible for many of the food grade and specialty varieties of soybeans. Minnesota is a leader in that area, and that's right now, as I indicated before, that's probably the biggest single
chunk of research dollars that the Soybean Council puts out each year is towards the breeding programs, because the breeding program is the basically the final result of the efforts to overcome many of the issues challenging soybeans. Disease resistance has to be introduced, and it has to come to the breeding program. It's the only way you can get it in plants. SCN, the soybean system nematode resistance, aphid, soybean aphid resistance and such. They have to be introduced in, into the plant some way once they're identified, and that has to come through the breeding program. The other thing is our the breeding program in Minnesota ends up being the producer of many traits that ultimately private industry takes from the program and puts into their variety. So there's not only is there some direct, it's the direct effect that you see is relatively small, because conventional soybean production is a small part of the market right now. But the indirect, through traits that are developed and recognized in Minnesota's program and are moved into the private industry, is probably the biggest contribution it makes.
Representative Anderson, a follow-up or anything? Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, we just have handed out the priorities, if you have a list of their priority research. But in addition to that, we just came back from 3 days this past week in California, and spent basically 3 days in, like going back to college from my perspective, seminars for about 10 hours a day, dealing with such things as low carbon fuel standards, the CARB board in California, a number of water resources board, meeting with people from California, from different state agencies, from San Francisco in the terms of use of their biodiesel and a lot of different things out there. But all of it was centered around primarily greenhouse gas emissions and management of crops. One of the things that continually comes up in those discussions, for instance, what we learned in California was that California, City of San Francisco is an example, runs all of its public vehicles on 20% biodiesel, and they love it. From fire engines on down to emergency vehicles, to school buses, to their transit system, everything's running on 20% biodiesel. However, they don't particularly want it to be made from Minnesota corn or Minnesota soybeans. They look at it, and the word that continually comes up is sustainability. And so much of their biodiesel, as an example, comes from secondary use oil of fryer oil. And they actually have a program. Minnesota, if you think about this legislation, what we spend on things, they actually have $200 million a year that they spend promoting renewable fuels in California. And that goes from education and outreach programs to research and other kinds of things through one specific, I think they call it AB 118 or something, that is the program that does all of this. And they spend $200 million a year. However, much of their area is in the area of sustainable, and for instance, the person from the Air Resource Board in one of our meetings indicated that she wanted to be able to get green certification on every gallon of biodiesel that they use in California. So we passed out with this 10 principles for sustainable soil management, and I just thought you might, I'm not going to go through that, but I thought it might be an additional thing that you might be interested in looking, because our soybean group has been working a great deal across the nation on such things as low carbon fuel standards, and we have mixed feelings about a lot of things that are involved with that, and we think there's a long way to go for more research before all these things can be come to fruition. But carbon sequestration, all kinds of different issues, it's kind of a new field that a lot of the soybean efforts have been in, along with the National Biodiesel Board, and soil sustainability functions are wonderful. So I just pass that out for your information.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Comerford, thank you for joining us. And Mr. Schoenfeld, you're up again.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could switch hats. I also work with the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators, and I both do their lobbying, and I also act as their executive director. The Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators amounts to about 400 ag educators across the state. And yesterday, when you had the dairy people ahead of you, one of the things you heard about was the dairy diagnostic team. One of the members of the dairy diagnostic team are farm business management instructors. So one of the things I'd like to impress upon you today is that the Ag Special, and that's what this meeting is about, helps to fund, in part at least, of the Ag Ed program at the University of Minnesota. In 1997, the Ag Ed program at the University of Minnesota had been in somewhat of a disrepair situation. Now, people may not oftentimes think a lot about the importance of the Ag Ed program, but agricultural education, way back since the early 1900s, has been a cornerstone of all the research efforts that you're talking about. And it has been a cornerstone of most of production agriculture and more recently dealing with the sustainable and organic type practices. We have got farm business management instructors, for instance, that do deal with sustainable and organic, and we also have them that deal with traditional production agriculture techniques and so forth. And the dairy diagnostic team that we heard about yesterday, farm business management instructors across the state are involved in that. We have 187 programs in Minnesota that teach ag education in the high school. There are about 240 instructors in those programs, because there are some of those programs that have more than one instructor, more than one ag educator in those programs. In addition to that, there are approximately 75 farm business management instructors that are employed through the MINSCU system. And all of that is driven primarily by off of the St. Paul campus with the Ag Ed department at the College of Agriculture. I want to first say that we've been working recently, and I want to give great standing ovation to Dean Levine and his efforts. We have been very pleased with his efforts in helping to bring ag education to the St. Paul campus and the College of Agriculture. Traditionally, it was a combination of the College of Agriculture and the College of Education. There were attempts to move it to the East Campus very recently, and that was changed, and I think Neil C. and a number of other things played a role in that, but Dean Levine worked to bring it to the College of Agriculture, and that's where our students will now both receive their Ag Ed program and the general agriculture courses that they need for that program. And so this is a huge step in a positive way, and we can't thank Dean Levine enough for his leadership in doing that. Along with that, I mentioned that in 1997 we were kind of at the bottom of the barrel in the fact that we had about a half-time instructor at that time. And if I remember right, we had about 6 graduates in ag education. And we have a turnover in ag educators so that we need about 25 graduates a year to fill our attrition rate. We presently are getting between 15 and 25 a year from the University of Minnesota. In 1997, this legislature passed special legislation as part of the Ag Special, and it has continued to be funded through the university as part of the Ag Special, and $1 million at that time was added to the Ag Special specifically for agricultural education. Now, if you look through the line item budget of the Ag Special, I don't think it says that anywhere. But yeah, I think it originally did, but I think over the years, basically it's the notes of the university, and I'm sure the lobbyists of the university might be able to add a little bit to that. But they have kept their commitment for those fundings, and it's gone two areas. And this committee has heard in the past from representatives from the Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council, and Representative Tremba has served in that council, and I'm not sure, Representative Tremba, perhaps you can help me out, who else on this committee has been on that council, but...
Right now, it's Representative Hamilton and
Representative Brown, I believe, is a new member.
So the three of us.
In any case, the Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council has worked in a variety of capacities to improve ag education. One of the things that has happened is that we have improved the numbers of students in ag education tremendously. It's gone up about 300% over the last number of years. We've recently had some problems in the fact that we had built it up where we had 4 tenured track faculty about 3-4 years ago, plus 1 grad student that was working as an instructor. So we had 5 instructors there. For the last year and a half, we've been down to 1 instructor at the university. They have had a search going on to fulfill a second position because there were some retirements and some people that moved away and so forth. And that is presently kind of in its final stages. So we hope to have two instructors back there at the time. One of the other things that NEALC helped to do, and the funding that you provided years ago helped to do, was to create across the state greater access to the ag-ed programs of the university. And we did that through a couple of ways. Crookston, for instance, now has got basically a four-year program in ag-ed that they are added as kind of the second spot in the state that you can take most of your ag-ed requirements for. In addition to that, I think there are four or five state universities within the state university system. I think South Central Mankato State is part of it, and I guess I'd have to go back, and Ridgewater is part of it, but they call it 2+2 system. And basically where you can take 2 years at one of the, you know, in the Minsky system, and then the other 2 years to finish at the University of Minnesota to get your degree. And we do have a number of students that participate in that, where they start out the first two, for instance, at Wilmer, at Ridgewater, and then they'll transfer to the University of Minnesota at St. Paul and get their pass the last 2 years.
About 2 minutes.
Okay. The point is that that funding does come through the Ag Special, much of that funding. There also is a special fund that this committee helped to put some additional funds into it. The funding has never increased at the university since 1997 in terms of that $1 million original program. And I would mention that $1 million, part of that money went into NEALC, and part of that money went into instructors directly in the ag-ed program. And that continues. But throughout the years, there have not been increases in that, and that's why additional funds were put through this committee last year, I guess. At the rate of about $250,000 a year.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schoenfeld, just a quick question. What's the placement of our ag educators in the K-12 education school system?
There is always a shortage. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty. There's always a shortage of qualified ag educators. We struggle each year not to close programs because of shortages of instructors. And we do have, as I said, about 15 to 20, five students come out each year. Presently, there are caps at the university. There are 43 applications for the Ag Ed department as freshmen this year. The university is only going to accept 20 of them under their caps that they've got. So we're somewhat limited as to, you know, amount in as equals the amount out. The other 23 hopefully will be accommodated through the 2+2 system or Crookston or something like that to help with it. One of the problems that we have in ag education is that people like to teach, but in addition to that, if you have an ag ed degree, you're qualified to do an awful lot of things in agriculture, and we lose an awful lot of people to companies that take them out of education in other areas.
Okay.
And so,
any other questions?
Another question.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. And since I have the gavel and the chair has stepped out, Representative Shamansky or Torkelson, do you have any bills you want heard here quickly? I'm just kidding. I'm just teasing. So, meeting adjourned.